It's all in how you define your terms. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Well, as always, Barry, I'm glad to be back with you. I'm fresh from my vacation down in Orlando, Florida, where we interviewed Noelle Dielman of Camp American, my sister, at my mother's 80th birthday bash. And believe it or not, my mom still does like the bash, even though she's 80. So that was kind of fun.
Good for her. Well, we're glad to have you back and appreciate that because we were having some difficulties in the communications from last week that you basically handled things pretty much solo for us. So actually, while you were on vacation, I got a vacation. So that worked out all right.
Very good. Glad you enjoyed my time off.
I really enjoyed your time off. That's right. Well, Chuck, that's just an example of the fact that it's all in how you define the terms as to whether or not something works for you or not. And we see that often in politics, but I think none quite so, well, just overtly egregious as what came out of the mouth of Senator Tom Harkin here recently in talking about the debt situation.
Well, it's pretty clear if you know how to listen to it, Barry. And that's the problem we're running into. A lot of people are losing the ability to listen actively. And unless you're listening actively, this kind of sounds like it makes sense. It's only when you listen to it with an ear attuned to the language that these fellows in Washington speak, these ladies and gentlemen, that's when you start to get the idea that maybe there's something wrong in what's being said. And we do have an audio clip. So perhaps we should play that, and then we should break it down.
Some of our favorite things to do, breaking down the sayings of our friends in Washington, D.C., because it does take an interpreter.
Yeah, it does. And this one is especially important because it exposes the mindset, the two different ways of thinking about the economy that exist. And unfortunately, there's very few people on the other side, even people who are supposedly our friends on the economy don't necessarily think correctly about this. They think in the same kind of terms, just in a little more nuanced than this. This is a pretty blatant statement. So here's the audio.
I think, first of all, I want to disagree with those who say we have a spending problem. Everybody keeps saying we have a spending problem. And when they talk about that, it's like there's an assumption that somehow we as a nation are broke. We can't afford these things any longer. We're too broke to invest in education and housing and things like that. Well, look at it this way. We're the richest nation in the history of the world. We are now the richest nation in the world. We have the highest per capita income of any major nation. That kind of begs the question, doesn't it? If we're so rich, why are we so broke? Is it a spending problem? No. It's because we have a misallocation of capital. A misallocation of wealth. All of this wealth that's been built up by hardworking Americans has been accumulated in fewer and fewer and fewer hands all the time.
Okay, what's wrong with that presentation?
Well, first of all, Chuck, it's totally disingenuous. He starts with the false premise that he's surprised that people think that we're broke. Well, we, being the government, is broke. You don't run $16 trillion deficits and consider yourself flush. It's just not possible. I guess it is possible with this administration, though, and this Congress. The other part of it is, you know, he talks about there at the end, we go backward to front here, that all of this wealth that hardworking Americans have built is now being accumulated into fewer and fewer hands. Well, I think Harkin's being hypocritical here because he really doesn't mind the idea of all that money being accumulated into your hands. He just wants to limit the number of hands to, say, 535.
Well, exactly, Barry. That's the whole point here. This is not about limiting the amount of hands that hold the wealth. It's about what limited number hold the wealth.
Exactly. And whose hands are on all the wealth? Because when he says, so he laughs about we're broke, we're the richest country in the world, we are the richest country in the world, or have been, I should say, before Germany wants their gold back and Saudi Arabia wants theirs and China cashes in all their bonds. But when it gets down to it, the whole issue really is it's the government and their out-of-control spending that's breaking the country. There's still wealth accumulation and wealth creation going on among people who are entrepreneurial and who can break out of the cycle of governmental dependence.
Well, Barry, I think we're what they used to call hillbilly rich.
Yes.
It looks like a great big wad of bills because there's a 50 on the outside and it's all ones in the roll.
Or continental currency, one of the two.
No, shit. And there's a Cadillac up on blocks in the front yard. But that doesn't mean we actually have debt-free riches. And that's the answer to the question. You start pushing these number arounds. We got $16 trillion in debt, and we got about 150 million taxpayers. You start crunching the numbers about how much that means that each actual taxpayer owes.
I think it's somewhere on the magnitude of like $57,000 a piece, isn't it?
I think it's higher than that.
Or am I missing a zero? Is it $500,000 a piece?
We could get a calculator out and do it, but it really, the whole point is that if we all chipped in everything that we would owe on this, if somehow we were able to confiscate it all, that's the old story here. This is what liberals like Parkin don't understand. If you confiscated all wealth and converted it to liquidity and spent it all in one shot, that's it. There isn't any more. There will be no more revenue because all the assets will have been liquidated. And there is no longer any capital. Now, remember, all economic systems are capitalist at their base because they require capital to operate.
Yeah, communism, including socialism and communism. That's right.
Capitalism, in fact, if you know anything about Marxist theory, it required a quote-unquote capitalist phase in order to build the capital that the perpetual motion machine that was Marxism would then run on for the entirety of whatever time on Earth we had until the universe collapsed. Well, of course, that's a ridiculous scenario because there is no such thing as a perpetual motion machine, either in physics or in economics. Now, Parkin made an interesting thing here. If you think about this, Barry, misallocation of wealth.
Yes.
What does the word misallocation imply?
It implies that wealth should be allocated, but the plan that it's being allocated by right now, which is the free market, is wrong. We need oversight and control. In other words, you need to have someone who is sovereign over where the wealth goes.
Exactly. There has to be some entity, some conscious entity, allocating where that wealth goes. And his plea is that we got to stop people from appropriating that wealth. Now, what is the idea that this centralized power, this centralized conscious intelligent entity, what does it say that they would allocate that wealth? How can they have the power to allocate that wealth?
Well, considering that that entity would be Congress, they would have the power by just passing a law to say that if you have X amount of wealth, then we're going to take it all in taxes and give it to somebody else.
Yeah, as usual, I haven't asked the question very clearly. So let me put it to you this way.
Sure.
Who owns the wealth? If that centralized power can allocate that wealth, who actually owns it?
Well, of course they do.
Exactly.
The one who can tell you what to do with it is the one who owns it.
Bingo. The assumption, the presupposition in this case is that they really own all our income and wealth, and they allow us to keep some of it.
That's funny. You know, I know on Sunday mornings, Chuck, when I'm at church and we pass the tithe and I'm asked to pray over it, that I always understand that the fact that the Lord owns all of it, the fact the cattle on a thousand hills, etc., and that everything we have comes from the hand of the Lord, and that we, because we love the Lord and we want to serve Him, we give back a portion of what we've been blessed with in the tithe. The government's just the other way around. They believe they're God and that they've given everything or that they own it all, and we should just give it all to them.
That's how you tell the difference between a truly free biblical economy and a controlled economy wherein the state has taken over the position of God in becoming providence. The idea there is that wealth is finite.
Yeah, that's it.
And that they own it. Because they are providence, because they are the ones who have to decide how it's allocated, they have to have absolute power over that wealth. And in fact, he knows he couldn't possibly get away with it by stating it that way. So he comes out and he gives this story about how we have this misallocation of wealth. Well, it's amazing how many people buy that, because what it looks like is that, oh, goody, 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 I get to go pick the pocket of that guy over there who has a yacht, and I get a piece of that. When what it really means is, at some point, and we discovered this already, Barry, in the 60s and the 70s, well, actually the 40s through the 70s, when we attempted to do this growing socialism, we discovered that fewer and fewer and fewer people got ahead. Then the tax burden got higher and higher and higher and higher, and we were growing the welfare state, and yet there was less and less and less revenue. So the tax burden had to get more and more and more and more to keep the revenue stream up, especially the growth part of it. Well, how'd that work out? By the late 1970s, by the late 1970s, the economy was essentially a dead fish. We had what was called stagflation at the time, wherein the economy was stagnant, but the inflation was unbelievable. Because I can tell you, Barry, I tried to buy a house in December of 1980, and there were no mortgages available. But the guy told me, he goes, if we could get you one, which we can't, it would be 21.75%. And this was on a lousy $20,000 loan for a mortgage on a house in 7 acres. This is the kind of thing that you went through. I had to buy a car in 1981. And things were starting to improve in 1981, and I paid 17.5% interest.
People tend to forget those days, Chuck, and they think that we just can spend and spend and spend our way back to prosperity. Well, we keep spending like this, and it's interesting because we're talking about the sequestration deal in Congress right now, and everybody's talking about all these dramatic and draconian cuts. Well, if you really look at the numbers, Charles, spending is still growing. It's just not growing as much as the administration would want it to grow under any other circumstances. In other words, a reduction in an increase they consider a cut. Now, to everybody else out there, i.e. the taxpayers, it's still a spending increase. They're just not spending it as fast as they'd like to.
Well, you know, Rand Paul got interviewed, I think, yesterday and made that point openly. And nobody was really able to come back at him on that. I'm going to see if I can find a copy of that. Obviously, we can't do it tonight because we're almost out of time. But the fact is that that word is out there, and the facade is beginning to crack, because even Chuck Todd, and you know who Chuck Todd is over, I think, at NBC News.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck saying, how many times can Obama get away with it? Well, when your cheerleaders start asking how many times you can pull the same trick, over and over and over and over again, people are beginning to acknowledge that Obama, the whole sequestration deal was this amazing Frankenstein put together by Boehner and Obama and Reid to quote unquote force some kind of budget decision. And in fact, you know, Barry, Barack Obama has now been president over 4 years. We have not had a budget passed in that 4 years. We've been operating on interim spending bills.
I was going to say, because it's funny, because when Republicans were in control and we didn't get a budget, we shut down the government. But when Democrats are in control and they won't pass a budget, we can still continue to spend like drunken sailors on shore leave.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, Boehner is proving himself completely spineless by not saying, you know what, we're done with this. We passed the budget. We sent it over to the Senate. They won't pass it. You claim you're going to veto it, go ahead. Here's your budget. We've passed it. You do something with it. There's nothing else we can do. So you get the Senate to vote on it, and then if you want to veto it, veto it.
Yeah, it's called calling a bluff.
Exactly. And one thing I wouldn't mind doing with Boehner is play poker with him, because I'm not a very good poker player, but clearly he's a real bad poker player. So... And no, we wouldn't play for money. I'd end up with all these peanuts, I'm pretty sure. You know what, Barry? We're out of time. We do need to discuss this a little more. I'll see if I can dig up that Rand Paul audio.
I figured as much.
Yeah, we'll try to get it out for Friday. So,
okay, very good.
Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.